From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Nixon and Kissinger, their collaborations and rivalries, backstabbing, intrigues, and foul language. We talk with presidential historian Robert Dalek about his new book. He examines how they used their power and often disguised their intentions while running an administration that was unequaled in its secrecy. Henry Kissinger was Richard Nixon's national security advisor, then his secretary of state. But Dalek describes the two as co-presidents. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a collection of hyphy, a new variation on hip-hop that comes out of the San Francisco Bay Area. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to talk about one of the most secretive administrations in American history, run by two powerful men who needed and distrusted each other. My guest, Robert Dalek, is a presidential historian whose new book, Nixon and Kissinger, examines how the two used and abused their power. Henry Kissinger served as Richard Nixon's national security advisor, then became his secretary of state. Dalek's book is based on recently opened records, including national security files, Nixon tapes, and Kissinger telephone transcripts. Dalek says these papers have allowed him to reconstruct interactions between Nixon and Kissinger and others in the government, revealing the collaborations and rivalries, the backstabbing intrigues, and foul language. Robert Dalek, welcome back to Fresh Air. Now, you describe Nixon and Kissinger as being co-presidents, especially during the Watergate era. What do you mean by co-presidents?
Well, what I mean is that Kissinger was very ambitious for influence and power and dealing with foreign affairs. And Nixon, I found interestingly, didn't know Kissinger when he appointed him. He knew his reputation as a major scholar, as someone who had been a commentator on foreign affairs and published in a variety of journals and published a variety of books and had been close to Rockefeller. And he wanted someone who would, in many ways, though, be a cipher. And that's why he appointed William Rogers as Secretary of State, because Nixon prided himself on the fact that he knew a great deal about foreign affairs, was highly experienced, and he was going to run foreign policy. And these other folks around him were going to be, as I said, essentially ciphers. What he didn't understand was that Kissinger was a man of great ambition, not just great intelligence, and that very quickly Kissinger became a fierce competitor with the Secretary of State Rogers for control of foreign affairs, and then with Nixon as well. Now, Nixon resisted, and he would complain constantly to Haldeman and to others around him about Kissinger's, the Kissinger problem, he called it, the K problem, that he's constantly trying to elbow Rogers aside and take over foreign affairs. And he told Kissinger from the get-go, you are not going to have a major say in the making of foreign policy in the Middle East, because it would not be acceptable. You're a Jew, and this is going to be impermissible. But Kissinger pushed hard for a role in foreign policy there, nevertheless. And Kissinger's reputation began to rise more and more. The opening to China. Kissinger became the focus of press attention. The detente negotiations with the Soviet Union. Kissinger was seen as at the center of that. And questions were raised as to whether these were really Nixon's policies or were they Kissinger's. And it made Nixon furious, you see. But when Watergate came along after the 1972 election, when it really became a crisis for Nixon, his authority, his ability to control his own administration waned. And foreign policy became all that more important to him because his hope was that he could use foreign policy to blunt the Watergate crisis because he had no other card to play.
Now, you write that as co-presidents, Nixon and Kissinger wanted to ensure that the White House controlled foreign policy and that Kissinger implemented Nixon's plan to do that. What was the plan to have the White House control foreign policy?
Well, they would not let William Rogers in on their major decision-making. He was on the sidelines, so to speak. When Kissinger was sent to China to open the door to Nixon's visit in February 1972, Rogers was only informed at the last minute when the secret negotiations were going on in Paris between Kissinger and the North Vietnamese representatives. Rogers was not informed or not given a say in what was being discussed in Paris. And so they really pushed Rogers aside, and Kissinger became Nixon's point man in these Vietnamese negotiations, in the opening to China. And then also Kissinger had a back-channel role in discussing Soviet-American relations with the Soviet ambassador in Washington, Anatoly Dobrynin. And Kissinger would carry messages to Nixon. This is what Dobrynin is telling us. This is what the Kremlin is saying. And Rogers was out of the loop. And in some of these telephone transcripts, you see the anger Rogers expresses and at times talked about resigning. But he was a proud man and didn't want to embarrass Nixon. He was also a very decent human being. And he stayed on until the end of Nixon's first term.
Why didn't Nixon replace him sooner with Kissinger if he wanted to keep Rogers out of the loop? I mean, why bother to have a Secretary of State if you're going to keep him out of the loop?
Well, you had to have a Secretary of State.
Well, I mean, I knew that. But, I mean, why not like get rid of him and replace him with Kissinger?
Well, because he also did not want Kissinger to have too much authority, too much power. And, in fact, at one point, Nixon has a conversation with Haldeman, and Haldeman complains, and Nixon complains about the fact that Henry is pushing so hard for greater control of foreign policy and to push Rogers out. And Rogers is a kind of firewall against Kissinger. And they say if Rogers is pushed out, Henry will become a dictator, and that's the exact word they use. He'll take so much control, he'll be a kind of dictator. And so they're worried about his assertiveness.
Now, even though you describe Nixon and Kissinger as partners in power, a lot of your book is about the rivalry between them and like who would get the credit for each negotiation and who would get the blame for any failed foreign policy. Even like in Vietnam, describe the rivalry between Nixon and Kissinger during the peace talks to end the war.
Well, Kissinger was very eager to see the peace arrangement completed before the 1972 election. And Nixon resisted that because he was afraid that there would be an attack on him as much too cynical, that he was ending the war not because peace with honor was within his grasp, but because he wanted to win the election in 1972, be reelected. And so Kissinger wasn't thinking that much about the election. He was thinking about all the energy he had invested in those many, many secret meetings he held with the North Vietnamese, and then the efforts to bring the South Vietnamese on board. And in a sense, there was a kind of triangular struggle. There were the South Vietnamese, the Tu government, which was very resistant to making peace, believing, accurately as it turns out, of course, that it was a kind of sellout, that he wasn't going to be able, the South Vietnamese, the Tu government was not for the long run going to be able to resist the North Vietnamese pressure, that the North Vietnamese were going to eventually resume full-scale aggression against the South and that they would topple the Tu government. So Tu is very resistant to the idea of reaching a peace agreement with the North. Nixon uses him for temporary purposes. He wants peace. And, of course, he does take the American troops out at the start of his presidency. There's 545,000 American troops in Vietnam. And by the time the 1972 election rolls around, there are only 39,000 left. And he's largely convinced the public that he's ending the war. But he doesn't quite end it yet because he doesn't want this to be seen as an act of political cynicism.
My guest is presidential historian Robert Dalek. His new book is called Nixon and Kissinger. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Robert Dallek about his new book, Nixon and Kissinger, Partners in Power. You describe Nixon and Kissinger as working behind each other's back during the Vietnam War. What were some of the things each did behind the other's back?
Well, Nixon wanted to send, for example, Al Haig, who was Kissinger's deputy at the National Security Council. And then in 73, after the Watergate crisis erupted, Haig became Nixon's chief of staff. But he kind of wanted to use Haig to check Kissinger, and he wanted to send Haig with him to Paris at one point. And Kissinger resisted because he understood that Nixon was going to try and rein him in and keep control of what was happening in Paris by having Haig there. Now, Nixon, on the other hand, could not afford to put too much pressure on Kissinger because he periodically would threaten to resign. And by the time the election of 72 rolled around, Kissinger was so much in the public eye. He was such an important part of the administration and what was seen as the great foreign policy successes in dealing with China and the Soviet Union that Nixon could no longer afford to get rid of him. And then, of course, when Watergate came along, the crisis, of course, really erupts after the 72 election and speeds up in 73. And by then, Kissinger is absolutely at the center of this administration, and it's then that he really does become a co-president. And in particular, during the Yom Kippur War, which begins in the fall of 1973.
In what ways did Kissinger play a larger role than you would have expected during the Yom Kippur War after Egypt attacked Israel?
Well, first off, when the attack began in October of 73, Kissinger did not inform Nixon, did not brief him on what was going on for over 3 hours. The information came into Kissinger at roughly 6 o'clock in the morning, and it wasn't until about 9:30 in the morning that Kissinger has a conversation with Nixon. But he talks to Al Haig, and he tells Haig that we should tell the press that I am keeping the president informed hour by hour. And, of course, there had been no conversation. And so Nixon, in some ways, because he's so distracted by Watergate, is willing to let Kissinger run the show on this Middle East crisis. But he wants Kissinger to speak out in ways that demonstrate or suggest to the press that Nixon's very much in control. So that's one instance. Then a second example is that about 5 or 6 days into the Yom Kippur War, Brent Scowcroft, who was now Kissinger's deputy at the National Security Council, Haig having moved over to the White House, Scowcroft calls Kissinger up, and in this telephone transcript that I had to read, he says to Kissinger, the British Prime Minister wants to speak to the President in about half an hour. Now, this is about 8 o'clock in the evening. And Kissinger says to Scowcroft, we can't do it. The President is loaded. And they say, oh, my goodness, I guess we'll have to tell the Prime Minister that the President will speak to him in the morning. And in the meantime, Kissinger is more than happy to talk to the Prime Minister, you see. But the most dramatic example of this co-presidency was...
Wait, so Nixon's just like too drunk to deal with this?
Well, he's too drunk or he's sedated. I mean, and I'll give you this next example in which I think you can see that. The Russians... Kissinger goes to Moscow to negotiate an end to this Yom Kippur War using Russian and American influence, pressure on both the Egyptians and the Israelis. Now, the Israelis at this point, 3 weeks into the war, are beginning to have a decisive control over the battlefield, and they've surrounded the Egyptian Third Army in the Sinai Desert. The Soviets are very concerned about the fact that the Israelis can now kind of starve this army out and force a surrender. And Moscow tells Kissinger that we want to send paratroopers in, and we want you to share in this with us, and you send in a joint military force, and we will, in a sense, rescue this Egyptian Third Army. Now, Kissinger, Haig, talk about this, and there's no way they're going to let the Soviets send a paratroop force into the Middle East. And they tell the Soviets, we are not going to join with you. And then they say, Kissinger and Haig say, well, we've got to have a meeting. We've got to discuss what to do. And Haig says to Kissinger, again, telephone transcripts, says to him, where are you going to hold your meeting? And Kissinger says, the State Department. And Haig says, no, no, you've got to hold it at the president's house, at least symbolically, demonstrating that it's the president who's in charge. And Kissinger then says to Haig, where is the president? This is about 9:30, 9:45 in the evening, 9:50, I believe, in the evening. He says, where's the president? And Haig says, he's asleep. And Kissinger says, should we wake him up? And Haig says, no. And then a half an hour later, they speak again. And Haig says to Kissinger, well, did you speak to the president? You know, meaning, well, maybe you went ahead and woke him up anyway. And Kissinger says, no. He says, I don't want him charging around here. See, they meet at the White House, and there are seven officials, none of whom had ever been elected to anything. And they make the decision to raise the DEFCON, the defense condition, nuclear alert. Only twice in the whole Cold War did this happen. The first time was during the Cuban Missile Crisis when John Kennedy was president, and the second time was during this Yom Kippur War. Now, the next day, Kissinger...
Wait, and they do this without telling the president?
Well, that's my understanding, and I looked and searched, and there's no document I found in the records indicating that Nixon was informed, that he signed off on this. Now, Haig and Kissinger do say that, they consulted him, but there's no evidence they did. And the next day, when they get information, when Kissinger gets information that the Soviets are backing down in the face of this nuclear alert, who does he speak to? Not Nixon, but Haig. And they say, Haig says to him, have you spoken to the president? And Kissinger says, no, I'm going to call him now. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I think he then speaks to him at 2:30 in the afternoon, half an hour later. And in essence, what they say is that we don't want the press, I'm paraphrasing now, we don't want the press to think or believe that we cooked this up. They do use that term, cook this up. And they've carried this off. Then when Kissinger talks to Nixon, Kissinger says to him, well, you've won again, Mr. President. And Nixon is happy that they've done this. And they're confident that Nixon would have signed on to this. And they're probably right. But nevertheless, they didn't have his direct commitment or authority to do this. So I found it pretty shocking.
Yeah, well, you're a presidential historian. You've written about, four presidential administrations.
Yeah.
So did this seem kind of unprecedented to you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was startled by this, amazed that, but Nixon, and I raise questions in the book about why didn't they think of invoking the 25th Amendment to the Constitution? This could
saying that the president was not equipped to carry out his full duties.
Yeah. That he was incapacitated, you see. But what they understood was that Nixon would have resisted this like mad, and that he might then have threatened to fire them, or indeed fired them, as usurping his authority, as carrying off a kind of political coup. Now, Nixon was not so incapacitated that he couldn't function. I mean, he was erratic, you see. He might be drunk, he might be on sedatives, he might be asleep, he might be out of it, but he had enough wherewithal to carry on day to day. And so if they had threatened him with suspending his authority as incapacitated, Nixon, rather Kissinger, Haig, they were confident he would have fought back. And also, if Kissinger had done that, it would have jeopardized his position with Nixon. And he wasn't going to do that. And so and additional point I'd make is that Kissinger kept saying that this Watergate crisis is so undermining the White House authority, the presidential authority, that it's injuring, undermining, jeopardizing American national security. Well, if you really believe that, why doesn't he invoke that 25th Amendment, suspend Nixon's authority until the Watergate crisis is cleared up, let Gerald Ford take over? He became the vice president after Agnew was ousted, and have a functioning president there. Well, but he doesn't do it.
Let me suggest the possibility that maybe Nixon and other members of the White House were covering their own behinds in protecting Nixon, because for Kissinger to have said, well, look, our president has been drinking too much and he's on sedatives, and we've protected him this long, but it's gotten to the point where mm-hmm. he's not really functioning fully as president, then everybody would have said, well, how did you let it reach that point in the first place?
Of course. I couldn't agree more. They were vulnerable at that point, too. And what I argue in the book is that that Kissinger was in many ways complicit with in trying to rescue Nixon during this Watergate crisis. You see, his highest priority is to keep Nixon in place and keep his authority in place. And never mind that there was a cover-up, never mind that there may have been serious criminality here, violations of law of the Constitution, they want to hold on to power. And it's so striking to me that when Nixon resigns, he doesn't say, I'm resigning because I crossed the line, I've committed congressional transgression. What he says is, I've lost my political support in Congress. It's as if he's a prime minister who has to resign because he doesn't have continuing congressional or parliamentary support. And of course, that's nonsense. But he won't fess up to the fact that he's done anything of a criminal nature. And then, of course, Ford pardons him and suspends forever the adjudication of that question.
Robert Dalek will be back in the second half of the show. His new book is called Nixon and Kissinger, Partners in Power. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, in stores and online at bn.com. And from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting Notes on a Scandal, starring Judi Dench and Cate Blanchett, now on DVD. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, put-downs, ethnic insults, and a few bleeped expletives. We talk about language Nixon and Kissinger sometimes used to describe each other and the press as we continue our conversation with Robert Dalek, author of Nixon and Kissinger. And Ken Tucker reviews Hyphy Hits, a collection of a new variation of hip-hop known as Hyphy.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with presidential historian Robert Dallek, author of the new book Nixon and Kissinger, Partners in Power. It's based on recently opened documents, including national security files, Nixon tapes, and Kissinger phone transcripts. Now, we were talking about how during the Yom Kippur War, after Egypt attacked Israel, that Kissinger and Haig took over and kept Nixon in the dark for a while about what was going on, which is kind of paradoxical, because the Nixon administration tried to keep Kissinger earlier on from participating in Middle East policy discussions because Kissinger was Jewish. And you quote Haldeman as saying, didn't Kissinger understand that if he was involved and something went wrong, they're going to say it's because a goddamn Jew did it, rather than blaming the Americans? And Nixon agreed with him.
Yes, absolutely. And Nixon, of course, had a kind of, it's difficult to describe it, but a kind of cultural anti-Semitism. I interviewed Kissinger, and we talked about some of this. And we did agree that Nixon's anti-Semitism was a kind of cultural anti-Semitism, by which I mean, you know, a kind of small town, Southern California culture in which he saw Jews as sort of undesirable types. He stereotyped them. But he was nasty about this, and it was one of his ways of trying to put Kissinger in his place. And he would say negative, ugly things about Jews, and then he'd say to Kissinger, "Isn't that right, Henry? Isn't that right?" And Kissinger would supinely respond, "Well, Mr. President, there are Jews and there are Jews." And Kissinger would try and interject commentary at some meetings about the Middle East. And Nixon would then say, "Well, can we get an American opinion now?"
I mean, was that maybe because Kissinger was German-born?
Well, I think not just German-born, but a German Jew.
You say that Nixon sometimes called Kissinger a Jew boy behind Kissinger's back, and occasionally to his face.
Yes.
Did you see Jew boy references in transcripts and that you read?
Well, you know, on that count, I must say that I got that from a secondary source, that he would say it to his face. There's lots of information in Walter Isaacson, for example, and Richard Reeves, who spoke about, wrote about this. I found, but I mean, there is plenty of stuff. I mean, for example, when there's a conversation between Haldeman and Nixon about the fact that Henry is late to a meeting, and Haldeman says to Nixon, "Henry's late. He's always coming late." And Nixon says, "Of course he's late. He's a Jew, isn't he? Jews are always coming late." I mean, you know, it's just astonishing.
It almost sounds like a bad marriage. I mean, you describe Nixon and Kissinger as being co-presidents, but it sounds like a bad marriage at times, because you describe them as needing each other, depending on each other, but also being incredibly jealous of each other and having a rivalry. And Kissinger refers to Nixon as that madman, our drunken friend, and the meatball mind.
Right. And, Kissinger, when he didn't like people or was frustrated or irritated by them, he'd call them maniacs. And the South Vietnamese and North Vietnamese, they're maniacs, he said to some journalists. Spending an afternoon with them is like a week in an insane asylum. And anybody who was, he calls Rogers at points, a maniac. And he's very negative about, but you see, what's so interesting is they're rivals. And you see this, for example, when Nixon comes off the plane in China, on his arrival there in February of 72, and he tells Kissinger and everybody else on the plane, "Nobody comes out with me. I come out myself," because he wants the photographs to be strictly of Richard Nixon on this at this moment, in this great, extraordinary diplomatic initiative, this breakthrough in Sino-American relations. And Kissinger's not going to get credit. He's in the back of the plane. And Kissinger talks about this in his memoirs. He said if he was told once, he was told a dozen times that he wasn't going to get off the plane at the same moment with Nixon. Well, you know, he was jealous of Henry, but there was such an insecure man. There is the material about him. The last day they're in China, they spend the last night in a Shanghai hotel. Nixon's in a suite of rooms, and he's been drinking these Mai Tais and Mao Tais, and he's sloshed. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, he calls Kissinger and Haldeman to come to his suite of rooms, and he wants assurances from them that the China trip was a great success, that it's going to be remembered as a landmark moment in his presidency. And Kissinger describes him as this lonely, insecure man who, and I say in the book, Nixon was the sort of fellow who couldn't take yes for an answer. In some ways, he was better off, was more comfortable with a crisis in which he had to prove himself, rather than a moment of triumph when he could feel that he really achieved something extraordinary. And that's, of course, the positive side of their relationship. They did have a shared understanding of what needed to be done about China, that it was impermissible with a country of 750, 800 million people to continue to isolate them. And also the idea that you used China as a kind of balancing wheel against the Soviet power and détente. They believe in détente because they understand, wisely so, that a nuclear war with the Soviet Union is out of the question. So there is a marriage that is constructive here that produces some landmark achievements that will echo through history forever. But as you said before, they are fierce rivals, and it's a bad marriage in some ways.
My guest is presidential historian Robert Dalek. His new book is called Nixon and Kissinger. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Robert Dalek about his new book, Nixon and Kissinger, Partners in Power. So, you know, when you're reading what happened behind the scenes during the China negotiations, does the story look very different than the headlines looked? And, you know, everybody seems to credit China as Nixon's most important foreign policy achievement. But when you look behind the scenes, is there something going on that we weren't aware of that changes how that breakthrough looks?
Well, what you see on the China issue is that Nixon's, as I just described, his insecurities, his uncertainties. Of course, he presents it as a very positive and certain policy, but he has his doubts, and that was particularly true on Vietnam. You see, what I find interesting with this material on Nixon and Kissinger is that this was the most secret administration in American presidential history until maybe this current administration. And yet, it is the most transparent of administrations because the documentary record is so abundant, is so huge, and available now. You know, 30-plus years after that, the end of the Nixon presidency, we can go behind the scenes and see that, for example, on Vietnam, they would speak confidently in public that they were getting peace with honor, that Vietnamization, the training of the Vietnamese, was working, it was effective, that they were going to be able to take over the fighting against the North Vietnamese because we trained them so effectively, we had invested so wisely in building them up. Well, behind the scenes, they have tremendous doubts about this. They talk about the fact that we can't win in Vietnam. There's not going to be a military victory there for us. We have to get out. They understand that this is a very hot political issue in the United States. And in fact, in the Haldeman diaries, which are another source for this book, Haldeman has a conversation with Kissinger in December of 1970, in which Haldeman says to Kissinger, the president wants to get out of Vietnam by the end of 71. And Kissinger says, bad idea. Because if South Vietnam is destabilized in 72, it could jeopardize Nixon's reelection. That's the thrust of what Kissinger is saying. And they stay on into very close to through the 72 election, and you see there's a kind of political cynicism to it. And they talk then about peace with honor. And after this peace agreement, there's never peace there. There's never an full end to the war. There continues to be bloodshed. Of course, it falls off the headlines in the American newspapers because American troops, American boys, are not being killed. And yet, at the same time, there's a continuing struggle. And they hide this. They keep talking about peace with honor.
So, you know, it's amazing because on the one hand, like you described Nixon as really wanting to get out of Vietnam because mm-hmm. he realized the war is failing, it's not winnable, and it's a losing battle with him too, with the American public. But at the same time, he's postponing an effective negotiation to the end of the war because he mm-hmm. thinks people will be cynical if he negotiates
Terry,
it at about the same time as the elections.
He's very ambivalent about the entire Vietnam business because he and Kissinger believe that if they leave with their tails between their legs, it will undermine, destroy almost American credibility with its adversaries, with its allies. What they missed, I say in the book, is the fact that American credibility was being undermined constantly by our continuing involvement in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And that what was more realistic was for us to get out, cut our losses, and use our resources in much more constructive ways. I don't mean necessarily in domestic affairs, but in the making of foreign policy. And they themselves are very concerned about the fact that will they be able to carry off the China and Soviet initiatives if the Vietnam War is continuing? So there was other fish to fry, and to coin a phrase. And they're very ambivalent about Vietnam. And also, they don't want to accept the proposition that America has been defeated there. Hence, you have the Cambodian incursion in April of 1970. He wants to beat up on the North Vietnamese. He wants to see if he can use American military power to really defeat them. And so he's in this, so to speak, experimental stage in the first couple of years over Vietnam. And you know, increasingly he sees that they can't carry it off, but they've got to get out.
Could you share with us one of the more jaw-dropping details that you came across in the recently released documents that you read through to research your book on Nixon and Kissinger? One of the jaw-dropping moments that you haven't already shared with us.
Yeah, well, I would say the most jaw-dropping were those moments during that Yom Kippur War when Nixon is asleep and Nixon is probably sedated and Kissinger and Haig and others are raising the DEFCON without Nixon's direct authority. Also during Watergate, how doubtful Nixon was about what to do and how to escape from this crisis, and Kissinger, who is constantly stroking him, "Mr. President, this country would be dead without you," constantly telling him what you do is so important, it's so valuable. I mean, all this was so, in a way, distressing to me to see the unrealism of Kissinger's response to Nixon. I did some interviews. The New York Times interviewed me about this book, and I was asked, how did I feel about Nixon after having done all this work and studied him? And I said I came away with a certain greater sympathy for the man. I mean, not that I admire him. I think he was, in many ways, a very troubled and intelligent but troubled man. But I had a certain greater compassion for him. As far as Kissinger went, though, I've described him as a brilliant scoundrel because he was such a brilliant manipulator of the press. The stories I found, the conversations with all sorts of people in the press, and just astonished me.
You describe Kissinger as having complained to the British ambassador John Freeman in 1970 that the men around Nixon were a collection of rogues. Quote, "I've never met such a gang of self-seeking bastards in my life. I used to find the Kennedy group unattractively narcissistic, but they were idealists. These people are real heels." So he thought that the Nixon administration was a bunch of heels, but certainly didn't reveal that to the American public and continued to work with them. And at the same time, one of the reasons you say why Nixon tapped the phone of the syndicated journalist Joseph Kraft was to see whether Kissinger was leaking to him.
Exactly. Well, there was such distrust. This, you know, as Kissinger said to a journalist at one point, "Well, I'm getting my paranoia under control." Now, you know, the old Freudian saying that even paranoids have real enemies, which of course they did. But on the nevertheless, there was such paranoia, and Nixon and the press. He despised the press. He had tremendous contempt for them. Now, of course, in public, he would say, "Oh, this is the American way," and he'd hold press conferences and he would try to stroke them. But when you see the things he says about the press, and I don't know whether you're going to want to run this, so you'll cut it out of the conversation, but he'd call the press sluts. It's just his vulgarity. I mean, you know, we talk about and bastards and sons of bitches, and I mean, and you know, every sort of group he could subject to. I mean, after the 1972 re-election, he talks to Haldeman about cleaning house, and they've got to get new blood in and new spirit in the White House for the second administration. And he says, "Well, we need some Italians and we need some Hispanics." But he said, "We're not going to be able to find them, and you know, we have enough Jews and people like that in the administration." And but you know, he just and he talks about he said the one person who we must keep on is George Bush. That's, you know, the first Bush, George H.W. Bush, who is at that point head of the Republican National Committee, chairman of the Republican National Committee. And Nixon says, "Well, we got to keep him on because he'll do anything we tell him to."
So having written this book about Nixon and Kissinger based on the papers of the Nixon administration, do you find yourself seeing the Bush administration any differently?
I think the Bush White House, to me, there are powerful echoes from this Nixon administration, and particularly on the Iraq War, comparing it to Vietnam. Nixon and Kissinger knew that we weren't going to win in Vietnam. They kept talking about peace with honor. They kept talking about Vietnamization, that the Vietnamese, South Vietnamese, are going to be able to take over the national security of their state and to defend themselves. And the same we see with this Iraq war, that the Bush administration keeps offering confident predictions of success in Iraq, of producing democracy, of building up an army that is going to, and a police force that will attend to the state's national security. But my guess is we're going to see the same outcome in Iraq that we saw with Vietnam, a failed state, and you'll end up with some kind of dictatorship there, and that you're not going to succeed in Iraq, just as we didn't succeed in Vietnam.
In Bob Woodward's book, his latest book about the Bush administration and the war in Iraq, he wrote that Kissinger had been brought in by the Bush administration to advise the president. What was your reaction when you found that out?
I said, uh-oh, because Kissinger apparently is telling him you must reach for victory. But my cynical view of this is that Kissinger may have also told him you must present this as a victory as opposed to achieving a real victory. Because it's hard for me to believe that Kissinger sees the war in Iraq as a possible victory. And so I think he's offering up a politically cynical view and saying you must present it as some kind of victory.
Robert Dalek, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure, Terry.
Robert Dalek is the author of the new book, Nixon and Kissinger, Partners in Power. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a new collection of hi-fi, a variation of hip-hop. This is Fresh Air. About 10 years ago, a new variation on hip-hop became popular in San Francisco's Bay Area. It's called hyphy, slang for hyperactive, and it's gaining in national popularity. Rock critic Ken Tucker says it represents a more playful, energetic version of current hip-hop. Here's his review of a new anthology of Bay Area acts called Hyphy Hits.
Mr. Fab! Yeah! Hush, with the hood stars!
San Quentin in here!
Oakland and EPA, man! Hood stars in the
hood! Y'all got a movement!
What's going on? Tracks, you a move, boy! Y'all a
yeah!
So clean, so clean, so
my slacks on my can of song. Park a scraper, scraper, rock the Benz on chrome. Button up, leather coat, Izzy cologne. Cruise down the street, knocking old school songs. Still a hood star, cause I'm riding with the chrome. Looking real fresh, real triple OG. With my sunglasses on like Kumo D.
As you can hear from that song by a group called Dem Hoodsters, hyphy is a genially rambunctious musical style that takes a riff or two and then surrounds them with raucous voices shouting, crooning, and laughing. To listen to the various acts collected on the Hyphy Hits collection is to be invited to a party that doesn't stop, with each guest trying to wear the biggest, loudest lampshade on his or her head. A hyphy manifesto of sorts is this tune, which salutes hyphy's birthplace, Oakland, California, and is called Go Dumb.
Hey, yo, this Z-Rock in the Yin Yang. And me and my little brothers, we the musicians. If you don't know our name, it's D-Rock, Courtney, and Mr. Ball. Hey, we got a new dance for y'all called Go Dumb. It originated in Oakland. So a big shout out to Oakland for this. I want all y'all to go dumb, baby.
Step up in the club, we gon' go dumb. What it mean? Take your head, stomp your feet, get crunk. We came to the club to have a ball. Go dumb, get fucked wild, stupid and all. If it's from Oakland, you know what I mean. When I say go dumb, I go dumb. Go dumb, stomp your feet, I'll throw your hand in there. Go dumb, get crunk like it just don't care.
Yeah, I ride, blow on by, when that bow is high. Got me sitting so high, I don't even see the haters when they see me ride by. Feeling like I'm in the plane, cause you know I'm too fly.
Most hyphy music is built around keyboard and synthesizer chords. There's little of the sampling of other people's hits as there is in so much other hip-hop, and there aren't too many guitars to be heard. The result is music that's totally divorced from rock and very connected to techno music. But what makes hyphy appealing to me is that hyphy offers the exact opposite of techno's cool reserve. This is hot, sweaty music, pulsing and pounding with energy and enthusiasm. There's a playful element that's most clearly heard on one of this album's best cuts called Stewie, which includes both children's voices and the vocals of Hyphy's biggest star, the rapper called E-40.
I'm Stewie, I'm hot. I get Stewie like that cartoon character Family Guy.
Family Guy.
Got my motorcycle club on my leather vest. Today I'm on my Harley, but I also got a Harlan Nest. I ain't starving, ain't no flies on my rubber bands. I'm having my Gouda out. Gouda means cheese, man.
Cheese, man.
That's another word for money pimping. Look at all my young dreadheads. They so dummy.
For those cultural anthropologists among you, E-40 claims that Snoop Dogg stole his famous irritating phrase, for shizzle, from E-40 and hyphy slang. I would not hold this non-crime against hyphy, however. Among other of its distinctions, hyphy mostly rejects the gloomy, violent, misogynistic scenarios of gangster rap. Its best songs serve as a critique of that genre. Instead of yammering about dealing drugs and brandishing guns, hyphy devotees like to joke about having grapes, that is, drinking wine, and dancing in clubs or out in the street. The idea is to make a song a kind of movie soundtrack for an urban party scene.
I pull a heater, man, never follow a leader, man. Even though we try, it's hard to beat them, man. Put up or shut up, my loot up, so what's up? What would you do if I shot your hood up?
Either jealous, smoke weed, I'll take the cuffs. That's F-A-E, not fabulous.
What it is, sick what it is.
The way this money look, I'll be independent for years. It's a gang of hood niggas eating off this plate. So don't come around here if you ain't from this place. Hear me coming by the half a block. Got a dent in my ceiling from doing the robot. Catch all kind of buzz from all kind of thugs. They off a designer, all kind of drugs. I'm married to the F, pistol under the battery, dope in the dash.
This, oh, we're sick with it, we is super sick with it. Scraper, scraper, full up with rippers. Purple, purple, gone off the liquor. This.
I'm Married to the Air, says a voice that floats to the surface of that song, Super Sick With It. And it's that kind of airy absurdism that nudges Hyphy's hip-hop into a kind of art movement. These California celebrators are breaking down, fracturing, and reassembling, making a kind of abstract expressionist version of hip-hop. They would deny such ambitions, most likely, but it takes real artistry to sound so casual and so bursting with the joy of life.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Hyphy Hits. If you want to catch up on editions of Fresh Air that you missed, you can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menjivar, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
Got blunts, got weed, roll it up, OT. Hit it once, hit it twice, I'm gone, yeah, I'm in.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Kiwis Might Fly, a New Zealand travel adventure by Polly Evans, author of It's Not About the Tapas. From Bonterra Vineyards, Mendocino, California, fine wines made with organically grown grapes and respect for the earth. Bonterra promotes responsible drinking. And from creditcards.com, an online destination for consumers to search, compare, and apply for credit cards. On the web at creditcards.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
When President Bush made the case for invading Iraq, he referred to Iraq's attempt to buy uranium from Niger. But that was based on forged documents. On the next Fresh Air, the Italian connection in planting and forging the documents. We talk with Italian journalist Carlo Benigni. He broke the story and has written a book called Collusion. Join us for the next Fresh Air.